From WGCU News, this is Gulf Coast Live. Public universities in Florida are in the practice of establishing private corporations they say are either not subject to or have exemptions from parts of the state's broad public records law. But when it comes to lawsuits against them, they're seeking the same legal protections that government agencies receive. We explore how this limits public scrutiny and the implications in the courtroom. And a recent United Way report finds nearly half of all Florida households struggle to pay for basic needs, even though the state's official poverty rate stands at just 15%. We take a closer look at the report's findings and methodology. Plus, November marks National Adoption Month. We'll take a closer look at what it takes to foster or adopt a child and why the need for adoptive and foster parents is growing here in Southwest Florida. First, this news. Welcome back to Gulf Coast Live. I'm Topher Forges. Almost half of all Floridians are struggling to make ends meet. That's the takeaway from a new report by the United Way. It's called the ALICE Report, which stands for Asset Limited, Income Constrained, Employed. It was done in partnership with Rutgers University Newark School of Public Affairs and Administration. The report states Florida's 15% poverty rate doesn't properly show exactly how much people are struggling when it comes to necessities such as housing, food, childcare, and transportation. Part of this is because the federal metrics for defining the poverty rate have not been updated since 1974. So the United Way and its partners set out to create a new set of standards that take an even crisper look at poverty in Florida. Joining us to talk about those standards is Lars Gilberts, the Florida United Way statewide director of the ALICE Project. Lars, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
So let's start with the difference between the federal poverty line and what the ALICE standard, how it's different.
Yeah, absolutely. So the federal standard, as you pointed out there, it was developed back in 1965 and it hasn't been updated since 1974. And what makes it even worse is that it's one standard for pretty much all of the U.S., so it doesn't take into account that, you know, New York versus, you know, Iowa might be different, let alone between communities within a state. So I think just at so many levels with how it was developed back in that time, a third of people's income went to food. And just things have changed so much, and it's so out of date that a lot of federal programs and state programs, you'd be over the federal poverty to qualify for it. And so it just doesn't work on so many levels. And rather than fix it, people have just tried to take a higher percentage of it, and we realized that doesn't work. We needed to be able to see who we were actually working with, and that's why we try to set a reasonable threshold to be able to see who is above poverty, below making ends meet.
And is that what's called the ALICE threshold?
Yeah, absolutely. And we try to be very careful because, you know, we're not the first people to have attempted this to see who is struggling because, you know, back in the day, you had, you know, people that were poor, middle class, and the wealthy, and that's kind of summed things up. But we've known for such a long time now that there's this group that's between poverty and middle class, but we couldn't really see them, and people would always have issues with numbers that people set. So we created, in partnership with Rutgers, a pretty cautious ceiling. So the floor being that broken federal poverty level, but the ceiling is looking at, you know, not what's the average cost. But, you know, for an example, if we're creating a ALICE threshold for a single guy, you know, I'm a single guy, I've got a one-bedroom apartment, but when I was in this population, you know, I got an efficiency, and I didn't pay the average of the market, you know, looking at 40% of that, looking also at, you know, car, not saving up for replacing the car, just basically keeping it running insured. For food, not eating out, buying BOGO wherever you can, using the coupons, and never throwing anything away. That's how we built this budget incredibly cautiously, and even still with that, we had 30% of the state that was above poverty but below that threshold.
And yet, the report says that ALICE households exist in all age groups, across all counties, and represent a cross-section of Florida's population. What does that tell you about the nature of poverty in Florida?
Well, I think one thing we are trying to do is change that conversation, because when we talk about poverty, no one wants to think of themselves as poverty. And, you know, a lot of us can be broke, and I would say that, you know, poverty is more of a state of mind. And since we already are saying that the federal poverty level doesn't make sense, and when we're looking at 45% of our total state being under this threshold of what it would take to survive, I would like to kind of even get away from the terms of poverty. So what I would say is that it shows that a lot of our state is struggling, and there's a lot of research that's pointed that out, new research recently talking about, you know, the median income and home ownership, and just it's not feasible for a lot of people in Florida, worse than a lot of places in the country. And when we look at some of the jobs that we have, the economy that we have, we're not necessarily creating jobs that will provide what people need to be able to provide for their family. So I think what we're seeing is that people struggle. They're finding ways to make ends meet. People are doubling up. People are pooling resources wherever they can. But one of the consequences is that Florida relies on growth to make ends meet at a state level and on a budget level, and yet we have families that can't grow, that can't move out, that can't have their own place, they can't buy all the things to outfit that new place that would stimulate the economy. And so as a result, the economy is keeping people in this place, but it's also they are keeping the economy in this place, and so we're kind of in a desperate struggle right there.
And you mentioned jobs, and income constrained is part of the acronym of ALICE. What, for the most part, do jobs look like in Florida, and what do they pay?
So we've got 69% of our jobs across the state that are making less than $20 an hour, and about 54% or less are making less than $10 an hour. $15 an hour. And so what we're finding there is that and the jobs that we're creating are all around that level, too. And when people say $20 an hour, you're like, wow, that sounds like a great job. When you look at an annual, that's $40,000 a year. So, yeah, $20 an hour is good. But when you're trying to support a family, $40,000 doesn't go that far. And it definitely doesn't go far enough into the future to actually plan for that. And so what we find is, you know, our business owners, they care. When we see them trying to do things, but oftentimes they're not able to know fully what some of the community needs, and that's partly why we did the report. But also when we're looking at wages, a lot of the wages in the state are high nines or around $10 an hour, so it's not even a minimum wage issue, but oftentimes it's how many hours do people get to work. And sometimes it ties back to their skill level. But just overall, our economy is not producing jobs that require full-time skilled laborers at you know, above $15, $20 an hour. And that's something that's not a business person's fault, not an individual's fault, but it's the way our economy is. And we really do need to shift that and create those jobs that can support families.
And you can join our conversation. Are you among the households highlighted in this report? Do you struggle to pay for basic needs for your family? Give us a call at 1-877-428-8255. That's 1-877-GCU-TALK. Send us an email to gulfcoastlive@wgcu.org. Post comments or questions to our Facebook page at WGCU Public Media, or join the live Twitter chat using hashtag GulfCoastLive. So, Lars, with the money that you take from a job, the report says that housing is the biggest drain on these households' budgets, and many ALICE households are renters. What are the challenges these households face when it comes to housing?
One of the biggest things that we're finding that we have now that's going to get much worse pretty fast is that there's just not access to enough affordable housing. And two counties, I believe, that are in your area there with Charlotte and Collier, both of those communities have about the same population that are above poverty and below the ALICE threshold. But when you start looking at the housing costs, there are a significant difference there. And so oftentimes it's not just housing, the transportation and housing, because people may say, well, I can't afford the housing right here, so I'll live further away. But then they'll have more costs in transportation and insurance, et cetera. But what we're finding across the state is that there's a gap. It goes from a few hundred in some of the smaller communities to Miami Dade. There's 163,000 units that could be in demand if people actually had the incomes and the housing matched the prices that they could afford to afford them. And so it's just it's somewhat of a complex issue, but it's going to get more challenging because right now about 18.7% of our population, so less than 20%, are seniors above 65. By 2025, more than a quarter are going to be over 65, and we're going to have more people over 85 than under 5 years old. And when people retire to our state, they often want to have a smaller, you know, that one, two-bedroom place. Unfortunately, our families that are already struggling to find affordable units are going to have to compete with some of our new guests who will stimulate the economy in some ways, but also be vying for some of the limited resources. So one of the other issues is that a lot of our affordable housing, it's further away, so we have a higher, you know, transportation costs, but also congestion, and also it's the older units. And so what we're finding across the state, there are a lot of places that people are living that aren't necessarily safe to be living in. And there's not necessarily plans to be replacing them or updating them. They're, you know, private ownership. This is not talking about public housing. And so we've got some issues there around landlords having affordable units that are quality near where people actually have the job. So it's on every level of the quantity, the cost, and the quality, and in pretty much every part of the state.
And you mentioned the population getting older, which also is something that the report touches on in terms of providing home care, healthcare workers for people at home. Can you talk a little bit about that?
In what regards exactly?
In that the population is going to get older, they're going to need people who are taking care of them, and that also puts an additional stress on some of these households.
Yeah, absolutely. I think what we see already right now, a lot of the, you know, the people that make our life possible, that are taking care of our kids, also taking care of our parents and other people, who sometimes is taking care of them, and a lot of the home health care aides and whatnot, they're lower wages, and unfortunately, how some of it's set up are set up as 1099. So they're actually set up as independent contractors, which means that no one is helping provide for their payroll taxes. It's all on them. And since they're not educated about it, you have individuals that are working hard that often where they need to go, they can't get there with mass transit because they're going to residential places and multiple in a day sometimes. So they've got the income issue, transportation issue, low wage issue. But then also, oftentimes, if they're 1099s, they end up at the end of the year when they're doing their taxes, find out that they now owe taxes and they don't have any savings because they didn't have enough income. So we definitely have some issues there, and that's why it's important to connect on that. Assisted living facilities and independent living that are places where seniors can actually get the care that they need in an efficient way, it will reduce the cost of living for the seniors, improve the quality of life for the healthcare providers, but presently we don't really have enough. We don't have ways to maintain the quality, and really there's even structures in place at the federal level that will prevent us from getting things done. HUD presently doesn't have some of the lending in place that you can build one property or the other, but you can't build a property that allows for independent living and assisted living with their dollars. So there's some things that we can do at the local level all the way through the federal level, but you're right. Those jobs are going to be challenging. They're going to be needed in our community. But if we don't address the housing, if we don't address transportation, it's going to make things even more challenging for those workers.
And we have a caller here. I seem to be having technical difficulties. But you mentioned the government, and I'm curious about some outside assistant factors. The report says an Alice household in Florida receives about $12,000 in cash and services from federal, state, local government, and nonprofit sources, and yet the numbers are where they are. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, and that's one of the things where we wanted the numbers to speak for themselves, and sometimes statistics help and sometimes they obfuscate. And because for some programs you can be above the federal poverty level, you have, for a free and reduced lunch, you can qualify even if you're above the federal poverty level because they realize that, you know, people that are above that struggle to feed their kids. So with that number is looking at the average across, but really when you look at those that are under poverty, that's substantially where the money is going. So when you're looking at people that are struggling with homelessness, families that have dealt with a significant health issue, all these type of areas, that is often where the most money is going. When you have a lot of the families that are in the ALICE population, they don't get the average. Most of them are getting much less than the average. They might be getting a few dollars here and there to help with a free and reduced lunch. They might be getting some assistance with getting back into their job. But in general, they're not getting direct cash assistance. When we're looking at tax credits, the earned income tax credit is a great incentive to help families that are trying to improve their income but are still not quite there. And that's often the one of the few things that the ALICE population gets towards the upper end of that range, where they are working hard, and during their tax credit, they get that earned income tax credit.
And we do have a comment from a caller who left this message. A city worker hired as a new hire but makes as much as someone who makes the same amount who's worked there for 7 to 8 years. There haven't been an increase in wages. How does that factor into these households?
Absolutely. And I think in that situation, we've got two types of issues that are happening here. So one, when you've got a when you've had a freeze on wages, and what we've seen is from 2007 to 2012, we've had cost of living go up by 13%, and really the effective wages that people are getting have gone down really by about 2%. So people are more challenged. And so if you've got people that have been there without a raise, and they hire someone at the same level, that I think it hurts at a kind of a personal level. What we're finding, though, is we wish that that was almost the case, but what we're finding overall is that the new jobs are actually making less than the jobs used to make. And so while that is personally frustrating and difficult, what we're finding across the economy, unfortunately, is worse than that. That new person that's coming on board that's doing the same job, that if they have started, you know, 5-6 years ago, they would have made more than they're making right now, and yet their cost of living hasn't gone down.
And what is this going to look like going forward? These numbers are based on 2012 numbers. What do you think is going to change in the future?
Yeah, so and one of the things, we really wanted to make sure this was a rigorous academic study, because again, United Way and people know that we care, and at the same time, we didn't want someone to say, well, you're caring so much that you're changing the numbers. No, let's use the actual government data from the best sources. In 2012 is when all of these things were available. In the report that we do try to tease out where we know that these things have changed, there's some trends, so we can't do a full comparison across the board, but in these areas, let's note. So one of those areas is unemployment. When we're looking at unemployment at the height in 2010, we had over 10%. In 2012, it was down to 8.4%, and now it's, you know, around 6%. And that seems to paint a rosy picture, but we all feel that that's not quite right. That's something that's, there's more to the story. And when we look at the underemployment numbers, which used to be the real unemployment numbers the government used, but discontinued, so who wants to be fully employed but isn't? And so people that maybe in your community, you've been looking for 2 years and just couldn't find a job, so you want one, but you've given up now. Or you got this, you know, seasonal job here, and you've got 5 hours a week or 10 hours a week. By the current standards, you're not considered unemployed. So what we do is we highlight the underemployed number, which it was 16%. It's gone down to about 14%, but it really hasn't moved, and there's more people that are working 2-3 jobs. So they are now fully employed, but they want one full-time job, but they're working 3 just to make ends meet, and none of them have any benefits or other stability that they need. So I'd say what we're finding is things are getting worse rather than better, and that's not necessarily what we want to hear. But that's partly why we wanted to do this study, because we all know that before a hurricane or before, you know, the recession, had we known the path of that storm or what would have happened, we would have all tried to do something different. And so now when we look to the future and we see that underemployment isn't dropping, the housing prices are going up significantly in just the last year, that we have more seniors moving to our community and we're not ready, that we're becoming the third largest state in the nation, but we don't have third largest state solutions, we know that something has to be done. And if we continue on our current track, it's not going to be good. So I think we've kind of got a three-part step, because we see the trend lines going out and they're heading in the negative direction. We believe the first step is just awareness around this. We all saw that there was a population between poverty and middle class, but we didn't know really who they were and how big it was. So we're trying to raise awareness around that. United Ways across the state are doing some amazing things. In Charlotte and Collier County, they're doing some great things. Tax season is coming up, and about 80% of people in your area there, and almost all the students, can do their taxes for free, either at a free voluntary income tax assistance site that's supervised by the IRS, and the United Ways are key partners in that. But also, there's a lot of other programs and services out there that people could take advantage of that could help stabilize their family, improve their credit, help them to make it from paycheck to paycheck better. But then in the end, we do need to stand up. And United Way have developed a consensus agenda. And each local United Way has additional points that they're advocating for at the local and state level, saying, here's how we make this a better system. How do we give people the opportunity to provide for their families? They're working hard, but how do we help them to make ends meet without some of the other issues?
And I think that is all the time that we have for today. Thank you, Lars, for being here.
Thank you so much.
Lars Gilberts is the Florida United Way statewide director of the ALICE Project. You can find a link to the report, which includes numbers for Lee, Collier, and Sarasota counties, on our website at WGCUnews.org. We're taking a short break, but when we return, November marks National Adoption Month, and local officials say the need for foster and adoptive parents here in Southwest Florida is particularly high. WGCU's John Davis explores adoption in our local communities. That conversation's just ahead. Stay with us. This is Gulf Coast Live on WGCU and PR for Southwest Florida. I'm Topher Forges.